Good afternoon. Welcome to the June panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. To my left, I am joined by Judge Grant Moore, and on my right, Bonnie, and I am Frank Tonight. As most of you probably know, we record these both audio and video, so to the extent we have any sensitive information, children's things, those types of things, keep that in mind that we stream live. I will say each case may be twice. Council can approach on whatever point, but just let me make sure I get it out full time. And with that, we will begin. Our first case of the day is State versus Washington. State versus Washington. Before we begin on this case, we have a bit of a procedural issue to address. And I just want to make sure both counselors are aware of the limit entry that was entered this morning.
Yes, yes.
So before we address the merits of the case, which honestly we can have to fix today, we want to discuss with you the procedural posture with your relief having been filed, pro se, he's represented by counsel, and the timeliness of that.
There were three issues that I received in the course this morning as to whether or not it's a pro se verdict, which I don't know how to answer that. I can say that 100% of the motivation I made was from Mr. Washington. I can say that at least 75% of case law that was given to me came from Mr. Washington. I know that I've filed pro se briefs before. They've been stripping because of they weren't formatted correctly. So I was really uncertain as to what the state was for in pro se briefs. I know some states require you just put a cover sheet on literally a written piece of paper and submit it. I don't know what constitutes pro se brief in the state of this court. So I don't know the answer if it's a pro se brief. I can just tell you what the process that I run through and submitting as to the timeliness of it.
It's 75% of the work in preparing the brief is from the appellate, 25% is from the state.
There was a portion, yes, absolutely. As I said, I submitted the original one, it was rejected for formatting. And so I took it that the court wanted much more formal pro se, a much more formal version of pro se. No, there wasn't.
Wasn't that the reason that that was stricken last fall?
I thought it was stricken because of formatting. It wasn't formatted correctly. I think you are.
My question on whether this is a pro se brief has to do with the designation that the brief was prepared by and signed by you. Well, I guess it was signed by Mr. Washington, but it shows prepared by you. And are you familiar with the limited scope representation rules?
I am. Where you prepare something and you sign it and you have no other involvement in the case.
And so to me, when I see that prepared by an attorney, that's telling me that that attorney is representing that client in a limited scope of preparation of every moment.
I think that's correct.
But the client is represented in a limited scope, so the client is not pro se. Would you agree with that?
Well,
and I'm not asking you to affirmatively agree, but it's a concern of mine, and we may ultimately ask you, well, they agree with this.
And just on that point, I would absolutely encourage you to have that objection to this court allowing the state additional time to submit a brief. I don't plan on spending any time arguing pro se for pro se. I think there's a range of what, as I said, what a pro se brief is. I practice in Ireland, and you put a cover sheet on it, and you submit the paper that the paper and it wrote it on, and that's accepted.
Except for being typewritten, you should be signed as bears.
So.
Which is permission.
Okay. Okay. Well, again, as I said, I was on strip, initially, and so, as I also said, as it seems a time delay, there was a, here, Mr. Washington was involved in a prison riot, he was injured, and he was shot, and he was placed in medical facility for a while, and there was some limited accessibility in Mr. Washington's for a while.
Do you remember that?
I don't, I think you do, and I'm not, I can't stand here today and say, he was in infirmary, I can't say that, but I do remember there being some concern about access to him. He was moved around a lot, and he was badly and I'm just giving information to the court.
There's a couple of issues that are raised in pro se that raise new issues that if they were not raised, we raise again. So then we create a post conviction, ineffective appellate counsel.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow you on your
own. There's a couple of issues that are raised in pro se.
Correct.
Not raised before.
Yes.
If we did not allow this to bar, then those issues would not allow the argument. It could not be a new direct appeal. It would have to be a post-conviction suspension to say that you were ineffective and you didn't raise
it. I understand that.
And that is the method of the process. Because if we allow you to do this as a precedent,
I understand that, and I totally understand that, and I totally agree with that. I can say that, just in my opinion, it's not frivolous. I'm not going to go as far and say it has merit that will prevail. And as you know, I hope an attorney has to pick and choose what to put into it and bring. And so all I can say in my opinion is the issues aren't frivolous. But I can't go any further than that and suggest that they have merit. And I am aware of an issue that should perhaps come back to the initial decision addressed to the appeal counsel for not raising the issue that perhaps is not frivolous and has merit. But as I said, I can go as far as saying that I don't see a frivolous issue.
And my concern is, in the typical situation, if that second matter had been filed by you and not against a counsel for we would say, in our opinion, additional assignments of error have been raised, but we aren't going to address them because the proposition of law that says, address it in your first brief, don't raise it in your first brief, we're not going to address it. So I'm concerned if we say, well, we are going to. Then what have we done to that rule of law? We've got to raise it first.
I understand. I don't. I intentionally did not raise those issues in my motion for the first. And I don't. I don't know what the answer to that is as to what. How would procedural posture for a pro se defender as to what it is. Can raise additional issues they aren't raised on the first brief. That seemed to be Mr. Washington's motivating force that didn't raise the issues, and he felt because of the procedural bar rule right out in Marshall, the procedure that we have in Nebraska where everything that's available on the record and it has to be raised on the record, that was Mr. Washington's concern.
I think this case law says that he has the right to do it. But the question then becomes, can it do it 3 business days before the oral argument? Because that prevents the state, that's easy to respond after this point, to use the assignments of this. There's all kinds of potential pitfalls in these situations. You want to make sure that Mr. Washington is learning his day in court, understand that. You should also have a look at what impact it has on his future cases.
I understand.
Mr. Mumford, we're going to come to state on their comment on that.
I'd reiterate my position right now. My motion to strike, and then quote unquote pro se brief will be stricken for several reasons. One, it's not pro se brief. Black's law and dictionary defines pro se as without return. The filing itself says prepared by counsel record. I don't agree that it's a limited scope representation of the context in this case. He's judged because he is counsel. There's no limited scope for representation agreement. There's nothing about that in the record. He is the counsel of record. He's representing his interests in all aspects. I don't frankly agree that there should be any sort of hybrid representation. I know that there are cases in our Supreme Court here in the state that allows supplemental pro se briefs. Generally, from what I saw, before the state had filed its brief, we also emphasize this at the trial court level. There simply is no right to such hybrid representation. It's a bit of discretion in court, and so there would be any reason to do that differently on appeal. Frankly, the timeliness issue to me is putting aside the pro se deal, the timeliness, lack of timeliness is positive. This court struck his first amendment brief back in October 2015, explaining, I think, both reasons, that it was one with no motion to file, the leave to file that, but also the formatting errors, basically, no summary agreement, no assignment errors, several things. He had a chance back then in October to file this, within a month, or 2 months, or even in his reply brief. He didn't. The briefing is done in January, 6 months ago. To allow the filing of a quote-unquote pro se brief, 3 business days before oral argument, I think is, not a good idea, put it mildly. And that's our position, frankly. I don't think there's any reason to file it. I think it disrupts the orderly progression of the case in this court. Frankly, it wastes the time of this court, as well as my time, preparing for oral argument, if I'm forced to continue, and then re-prepare in September or October. We submit that it should be stricken. I guess more accurate reason for the court should deny a motion for leave to file. I point out that in a similar situation, State v. Holmes had a 2010 case. This court explicitly granted the motion to strike, and that was an actual pro se brief. My colleague filed a motion in that case and basically had as much of the same reasons as he did in mine. Basically, he's represented by counsel. He filed a brief after the state filed its brief. I haven't had a chance to respond. This court granted the motion to strike. Right, Judge Castle at the time, 2010, again, in the Holmes matter. This court views to reconsider that in the motion to for rehearing or reconsider. I'm not sure what the actual motion was by the pro se defendant in that case. So, I just note that State v. Holmes matter 2010, case ID was A10294. It's a published decision in the opinion, but as far as the scales or justice. In the case ID would be A10294. The register of actions, the supplemental brief, pro se appellant was stricken, filed by Helmstatter, and the motion of the appellee to strike. Again, the reasons were he had counsel record, he already filed a brief on his behalf. The state's already filed his brief in response, and they raised claims that the state has not had an opportunity to correct. And then the court disposed of it, struck the brief, and pro se appellant motion to reconsider strike that brief was not very well. So that is our position. If this is a pro se brief, or if it is not a pro se brief, that his counsel filed this 3 business days before oral argument, after we submitted briefs back in January, or today, right, prepare, raises some issues, it should be stricken. That's all I have to say.
Please give us a couple of minutes to confer with the proceeding.
After consultation, I'm at the court. We'll go ahead and we'll argue the merits of the case today. Our decision on whether to strike the brief, strike to allow it, will be contained within under on the merits itself. With that, Mr. Luna, you may proceed on the merits.
And before you begin, I believe I understood you say you were quite a bargain with the points in the supplemental brief. Just submit it on the brief and it'll be to receive it.
I will not argue. I want to be pro se.
Thank you.
Yes. This is a case involving indirect appeal from the district court's granting Mr. Washington's post-conviction relief in the form of a new direct appeal. The record indicates that Mr. Washington was denied his right to direct appeal by his original trial counsel's failure to file a poverty affidavit. And as a result, the Court of Appeals dismissed his original direct appeal for lack of jurisdiction. Now, there are numerous ineffective assistance that counsel claims before this court. Not the least of which is whether his trial counsel was ineffective for not filing a motion to quash based on the unconstitutionality of Nebraska Rights Statute Section 28.12.12.04. The whole issue of whether this statute is constitutional or unconstitutional needs to go to the Supreme Court on the state of the record, and Mr. Washington's lawyer was ineffective for not filing a motion to quash. And we ask that the case be reversed and remanded to the district court so a proper motion to quash can be filed. We ask that the case be remanded with the ability of a lawyer to file a motion to quash below. Then, depending on how the court rules, we can go from there. Now, the state argues that the record is sufficient to address this claim, and the claim is without merit. And the state relies on state versus Sanders. But I submit that this issue should be decided on a case-by-case basis, and that the facts and circumstances found in one case should not prevent Mr. Washington from being able to raise this issue.
And so the Supreme Court said this issue, when you present it, is a novel issue.
Yes.
And that was actually found after this case was struck.
Yes.
So it was novel after this case was struck. It wasn't novel before the case was struck.
Yes, and
the Supreme Court says, counsel cannot be ineffective for raising a novel constitutional issue. Why isn't that the end of my story?
I go back to the case-by-case analysis, and every case is different. I think there's a case now before the Nebraska Supreme Court involving Michael Ross, and the issue is whether issues were not. It should be case determinative, or Sanders should control for all cases. And I submit that Sanders should not control all cases. And that's my response. Mr. Washington's principal signs of errors, besides the numerous ineffective assistance of counsel claims, is that the trial court erred in granting the motion to consolidate. The state cites Nebraska cases of Hilding and Schroeder. In Hilding, the defendant was charged with first-degree sexual assault and stalking. The court determined that they were related, that there was a natural flow from the stalking charge to the sexual assault. The other case, the state relies on Schroeder, involved a felony murder and forgery. The court determined the forgery, which occurred 3 days before the murder, was connected and part of the common scheme or plan, and that led to the other, that they were logically connected. I have provided the court with cases from a number of jurisdictions where the defendant has challenged multiple convictions in a single trial, and the appellate courts have found the trial court error in joining the offenses because they were not connected. Namely, Knight versus State and Macklin versus State. Here, in this case, the offenses were not committed and did not constitute part of the common scheme of crimes. One crime did not lead to the other, and they did not form a series of connected transactions. It must be remembered that Mr. Washington was a passenger, not the driver, on March 27, 2011. The fact that the driver might choose to flee law enforcement should not be attributed to Mr. Washington, as claimed by the state. In its brief, it indicates that presumably Washington knew that he was wanted for his involvement in the shooting, which caused him to flee. I would like to reserve time for rebuttal concerning the issue of prejudice. If there are any questions at this point, I'd be happy to answer.
Did you say the name of the person currently concerned in the court versus Mr. Moss?
Yes.
Is that in the present?
No, it's awaiting the appellate brief, the first appellate brief.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Court. My name is Oscar Earl. I'm from the state. I didn't have too much to add to what I said. I'm going to address counsel arguments. As far as the claim that effective assistance with our employees, there's 12.4, as Your Honor pointed out, as I pointed out, we have to elect safety standards to equal this issue, to follow the remedy issue, so that it was a legal challenge, time of direct appeal, and trial, 29.12, the exact same time frame as we have here. They determined that the counsel would not be deficient. We're not raising the knowledge of the challenge, same holds true here. That claim will be addressed and disposed of on direct appeal. As far as the consolidation of the information, I see the need to look at outside jurisdictions, outside the shorter, outside building, and proposition of law, and the facts of those cases. But if you look at the plain language 29-2002, same or similar character or based on the same act of transaction, two or more acts or transactions connected together, that they are sufficiently related based on underlying facts, based on the fact that the incident, or the 27th incident, the officer is finding out a car at a gas station, telling him basically to shout at him, shout on the window, telling him to stop. He turns over to the driver and says something, the driver takes off, they chase, they see him. Inferentially, the evidence shows they see him chuck out a gun. On the passenger side, they have a gun. The gun was one of the ones in the March 17th incident. I think it's eminently reasonable to think or to assume that he was fleeing the police because he was involved in that crime. We're going to be linked back and being linked back to being related to what you see under additional prejudice or the evidence is sufficiently separate and distinct. The Supreme Court states or explains that it's recognized that as sort of a end all be all reason for no prejudice in the context of the federal test here as well. So there was no issue with the property to join early prejudice. We submitted on that. As far as the other side of unless the court has questions, we submit that they are without merit. So the court can be sensing error. Sensing error that kind of came about because of the CS problem. This would be the force for that. And so we would ask this court to basically reinstate the sentences from the May 3rd, 2012 sentencing order. Sentencing order of the court.
Do you think we also have an option to imagine that we reset?
I suppose you do, but based on the
court remand to its original sentence.
Well, depending on the scope of the remand, if the remand was reinstated, you made 30.12 sentences.
Because there's a lot of confusion.
Sure.
Between the original sentence compared to what the judge wanted to sentence him.
I guess 2 points on that. First is I think it would make sense to limit it to what he's already done before, but secondly, I think that's the main reason why this court should do it. There's been a lot of errors, a lot of confusion at the trial court level about what can and cannot be done. I submit that this court should take care of that by reinstating the sentences from 2012, I think they're 2012. Sentencing order, which basically was 30 to 50 on the first degree assault. And then the use was 30 to 50, and then two more consecutive uses, 5 total of 70 to 110 years. And that will take care of the problem. I don't see any need for remand. I can't have it. Would possibly cause further problems. So again, I would ask the court to reinstate that order if that permit is not.
He has 423.
He has 423.
4 minutes. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to address Judge Somebody's question. I'm sure that the court would be moving. And I would say it would not. And I would say that based on the argument that's made in my supplemental brief on pages 8 and 9, it's undisputed that the district court intended to have.
Wait, I'm
going to
stop you. Didn't you tell us that you were not going to address the issue?
I'm not addressing issues in pro se brief.
Oh, okay.
I filed a supplemental brief on January 14, 2016. That was it. And on pages 18 and 9 on that, I argued exactly why this court should send it back for resentencing. It's undisputed. Well, the authority would be Johnson versus Mississippi, and as a trial court relying on inaccurate information makes the sentence void. And that was a death penalty case. But it cited on page 9 of my brief.
But do you have anything in the record to show that the original sentence was based upon erroneous information? We have the judge say, I meant to do something different. But we don't know where he got the information
in the record. We don't reckon that's
no problem.
Well, I think it would be a big problem if the judge didn't ask rely on the representation of the Department of Corrections. There's nothing in the record. There's a another case that exists, I believe, that's been decided, although I mentioned it in the supplemental brief, the Elamine and Frakes case. That's, well, at the time it was S-15-452, and S-15-453. And it addresses this issue of whether or not the court can sentence the person based on inaccurate information, specifically with the Department of Correctional Services.
But again, you have something in our record to show that the not have the correct information.
I don't believe there is.
Shows us where that there was a proper or stealing information. How can you say we're going to give you an opportunity to start over again? Only represent. I'm not aware of the authority to do this.
Well, I think if it's remanded for resentencing, that issue can be addressed at the district court level.
And you think that when you remand it for sentencing, you said the judge can impose a different sentence and one he can impose one issue?
I think he can. If he in fact says that he relied on the Department of Correctional Services, the inaccurate information from the Department of Correctional Services to determine his individual sentence.
He says that.
Concerning the prejudice piece, there's a case that I cite, which is very, again, I would just keep restating my argument as to the cases that the state relies on. I think they're clearly distinguishable, but on page 7 of my supplemental brief, I cite to a case called Hatfield, and that case just, I think, lays it out very clearly by the promotion of judicial economy by avoiding needless multiple trials is not as compelling when the offenses are similar but unrelated. And that's exactly what we have here. There are cases that are similar but unrelated. And it gives a very good analysis of what the jury may do. They tend to accumulate the evidence of various offenses and convict the defendant on all the offenses charged on the theory that he's a bad individual, rather than weigh the evidence separately on each offense. From the defense standpoint, trial on multiple offenses may make it difficult to establish separate offenses. And that's exactly what Mr. Monahan argued when he argued against the consolidation. If there are any questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The case is submitted, House Bill 62. Thank you. Thank you for addressing that consideration and support.
You're welcome.